If you want to think about racism, it can help, I think, to start with the sort of concrete events that the word evokes. So let's start with the murder of George Floyd and ask the question why it was such a galvanizing event as it was. It wasn't, after all, unusual that a black man was killed by an individual American police officer. That happens several times a week. At current rates, one in 1,000 African American men will die at the hands of the police. Nor was it that a human being was killed by an American police officer. That happens 2 to 3 times on an average day, most commonly with a gun. I'm sure that the extraordinary circumstances of the pandemic and the moods it created was also an important part of the context. The circulation of those images when we were all isolated from one another, something that brought us together in a rather strange way. What struck me most, however, was that the killer could see that he was being recorded. That video was not one of those iPhone videos taken of people who don't know they're being photographed. He's looking at the camera a lot of the time. He knows he's being photographed or videoed, and in a way it's almost as if that's part of why he's doing it. He's sending a message of defiance, directed, as far as one can tell, as much as anything else, at the young black woman who was filming him on her phone. You can see him thinking, I can do this, you can't stop me, I'll get away with it. And you have to situate that air of confidence in the context of the relationship between the American police and the African American community. In one study, there are a lot of studies of this, and of course they have slightly different numbers, but in one study, half of African Americans reported being discriminated personally against by the police, and the comparable figure for white Americans was 3%, so that's 50% of African Americans, 3% of white Americans. Also, American police are far more likely to approach African Americans disrespectfully and to deny them equal treatment and equal dignity. We know this from careful scientific assessments, like this one published in 2017 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which was an analysis of film from police body cameras. And almost always, nothing serious happens to the people who do this, whether the victim is black or white. Indeed, even though American police officers kill hundreds of African Americans a year, there have historically been almost no consequences for the officers who did it, certainly no serious ones, and there are very few criminal prosecutions, though there have been some recently. So you'll probably remember another notorious case earlier in the second decade of the 20th century, when Eric Garner was asphyxiated. And the officer who did that was fired from his job eventually 5 years later, but he wasn't prosecuted, even though in an eerie anticipation of George Floyd's death, Mr. Garner was filmed crying, "I can't breathe," and the video was seen by millions of people. Now, I'm pretty sure that Mr. Floyd's killer didn't think he was being filmed killing a man. I don't think that he intended to kill his victim. What he thought he was doing, I think, something police officers often do, was humiliating someone. And when I say police, that's something police officers, I don't mean American police officers. If you give people the kind of social power that police officers have, one of the ways in which they exercise it is by humiliating people, and I saw that as a child growing up in Ghana. So this is not a point about American policing. And as I say, he was also showing the people watching, many of them black, that he had no fear of being penalized for denying Mr. Floyd the ordinary decent treatment owed to another human being. Now, it's natural to say that this was racist because, or if you doubt, that he would have been treated in that way if he'd been white. But that takes us away from things about which we have much specific evidence in this case. Still, you have to grasp that the disrespect and the expectation that he would get away with it are not abnormal. They are part of the normal relationship between the American police and black people. Now, I'm not saying that most police officers do these things. It usually turns out that the officers whose bad behavior catches media attention come from a minority with a particularly bad record of civilian complaints. That was true of George Floyd's killer, and it was true of the New York police officer who killed Eric Garner. But it is true that most police officers who witness this sort of behavior don't do anything about it. And they, as in this case, there were two other police officers watching, and they didn't try to stop it. And then the system goes through the motions of looking into it, but almost always in the end does nothing, as I said. And given that this ends up harming black and brown people at a much higher rate than white people, some people would say that the system is racist. I mean, what other possible explanation could there be for the fact that there's a much, much higher rate of this sort of bad behavior in relation to black people than in relation to white people? And as you might guess, Hispanics are sort of halfway in between. Now, in cases like this, I think it can help to do what philosophers do, which is think carefully about the concepts that we're invoking, like racism, and so help all of us think about these issues with greater care. Our media, and especially our social media, are full of accusations of racism of this sort, and I think it's fair to say that there's no consensus on, not just on the definition of the term, but on, it's not obvious that there's a shared understanding of the term in those discussions. And that disagreement, therefore, leads to disagreement about cases. Some might say that the fact that there were non-white officers in this episode is evidence that this wasn't racism. And others might object to the very idea of speaking of a racist system. Only people can be racist, they might say. And so without a clearer account of what racism is, these debates aren't likely to make much progress, I don't think. Now, you might think that that doesn't matter very much. What matters isn't what we call these things. What matters is figuring out what's right and wrong. Racist or not, killing George Floyd was wrong. But I don't think that's correct. So those are the four officers who were eventually identified. Why? Why is that not right? Why is it not right to say, no, we just need to know what's wrong, we don't need to know, it doesn't matter what we call it. First, because in morality and the criminal law, we need to know what someone was thinking in order to decide how wrong their act was. Whether there are excuses or mitigating factors and the like, that depends on what they were doing. Not just on the results, is it? Not just on the outcome, but what they were doing. What Miss Hanscom would have called the description under which their act was done. And if the thoughts that guided Chauvin's acts were racist, and racism is a vice, then that may make his act worse, more culpable, worthy of greater punishment. It may also be worthy of special punishment for other reasons. Maybe we think that the existence in our society of people with racist motives means that we need to raise the penalty for punishment to achieve effective deterrence in cases where the victim is of one of the oppressed racial minorities. Someone who's willing to risk a fine in order to beat up a person of another race might not be willing to risk imprisonment. But second, it may be that a deeper understanding of racism will allow us to identify exactly what's wrong with it and what we need to do in order to get rid of it, to eradicate it. Without a clearer picture of the wrong than I think we mostly have, we may not put the right focus in our attempts to put things right. There's a third reason that we might want to have an account of what racism is. Without that account, we won't be able to distinguish it from other things. And some of the things, unlike racism, some of those other things may not be wrong at all. I think, for example, myself, that some forms of what's called affirmative action are worthy attempts to respond to injustice. But if you have the wrong understanding of racism, you may think that that can't be so because you think that racism is treating people of different races differently, and you think that affirmative action involves treating people of different races differently, and so it must be racist and wrong. Finally, as we'll see, at least when it comes to dealing with the racism, not of systems, but of individuals, it will be helpful to disentangle different ways in which people's behavior can be shaped by racial attitudes and beliefs. Some of these attitudes may be mistaken, but not immoral. That's important, because one thing almost everyone agrees about, this is a philosophical literature, so not everyone agrees about this, is that, and it's implicit in everything I've said so far, is that racism, whatever it is wrong, and that racist acts are the acts of wrongdoers. But people can be mistaken without being bad. Not every mistake people make about race should count as racism, I don't think. And people shouldn't be blamed for being racist unless their racial attitudes involve some kind of specifically moral mistake. Okay, so how should we begin to sort out the issues? The object isn't to track how ordinary people, at least my object, isn't to track how ordinary people ordinarily use some word. The idea instead is to give an illuminating picture of an important set of connected, in this case, wrongs. And so I suggest we start with the fact that racism, whatever it is morally wrong. Every serious person knows that in our country and our world, there are practices and attitudes that end up treating people in ways they ought not to be treated, in some sense, because of their race. That's the suspicion that guided many responses to the death of George Floyd. We need a way of talking about that fact. Even if some people did use the word racism to describe something that they thought was morally okay, we do need a way of talking about practices and institutions and beliefs around race that are not okay. Most of us already use the word racism in that way. Hardly anybody says seriously, that's racist and that's just fine. And if they did, most of us would condemn them. So one test of an account of the nature of racism is going to be that it should help us understand not just that racism is wrong, but also perhaps why, what's wrong about it, why is it wrong? And I should add, for the story to be plausible, it had better be some, there must be some core things that are racist that are not just wrong, but seriously wrong. My second assumption is that racism should have something to do with attitudes and behavior that are in response to people's actual or supposed race. There are other things like racism, sexism, Islamophobia, xenophobia, homophobia, for example, anti-Semitism. One thing that distinguishes them is the fact that they aren't grounded exactly just in the race of the people they are directed at. I'll say something about anti-Semitism in a minute. They're based instead on sex or religion or national origin or sexual orientation or something like that. This might seem obvious, but it raises a difficulty, because it seems to follow that racism presupposes a belief in races. And many modern scientists, biologists, anthropologists, and sociologists, think that the belief in races that underlies most racism is an intellectual mistake. I'll get back to saying what that mistake is in a minute. And while intellectual errors are sometimes the result of morally bad acts, such as ignoring evidence that you had a duty to pay attention to, or of character vices, such as intellectual vices like laziness or prejudice, having a false belief is not in itself automatically morally wrong. So maybe it can be morally wrong, but it isn't automatically morally wrong. These two assumptions then already have an important consequence. If belief in races can be a purely intellectual error and not a moral one, and racism is a moral error, then racism has to be more than belief in races. My final assumption is that the word racism should cover not just people who are racist, but systems of ideas, practices, attitudes, and beliefs, as well as institutions. What the connection is between the different elements of these systems is something that we'll need to explore, but after thinking about these things for many years, I'm convinced that there's a good reason that why we use the word racist to talk about so many different categories of things. But the proof of the pudding here will be whether an account that covers them all can seem to be both plausible and illuminating. Okay, with these constraints in mind, I want to begin to tell my story of what racism is and why it's wrong. Most people, it appears, don't know that the word racism came into common use in English in the 1930s to refer to the ideas of European fascist political parties, or some of them. One thing fascists in Europe believed was a nationalist, believed in, was a nationalist politics organized around a distinction between one race that properly belonged in the national territory and whose interests the nation state should serve, on the one hand, and other inferior races such as Jews, Roma, Slavs, Negroes, Asians, who were to be expelled or, in the worst cases, as with Nazism, exterminated. But the identification of the nation with a group of people with a common ancestry and inherited biological character was something that had occurred increasingly over the course of the 19th century as the new science of biology was growing in prestige. I love the fact that biologie, the word biologie, was coined in 1800, so it's... But biology is a 19th century subject because the word doesn't exist before that. So I want to take up the story briefly by... with an address to the nations of the world at the first Pan-African Congress given by the person I think of as the greatest African-American intellectual of the 20th century, W.B. Du Bois. In that talk, Du Bois proclaimed that the problem of the 20th century was the problem of the color line. The question as to how far differences of race which show themselves chiefly in the color of the skin and the texture of the hair, will hereafter be made the basis of denying to over half the world the right of sharing to their utmost ability the opportunities and privileges of modern civilization. So Du Bois believed, correctly as it turned out, that combating white supremacy would be a major challenge in the politics of the country of the century to come. And when he said that race was to be the problem of the 20th century, he did not just mean in his own country, these United States, and he didn't just mean for his own race. He saw the color line as a battle on two fronts, challenging the mistreatment of non-white people in Europe and the Americas on the one hand, and defeating Europe's colonial empires on the other. That's why he was talking, as he said, about over half the world. Elsewhere in the speech, he spoke not just of the millions of black men in Africa, America, and the islands of the sea, but of the brown and yellow myriads elsewhere. So Du Bois in 1900 had, Du Bois in 1900 had very much in mind the ways in which race figured in the European colonial schemes that were reshaping Africa and Asia at that time, as well as its role in the American social injustices that he had experienced growing up as a black child in Massachusetts. Civic and economic inequality between races and ethnicities, whether produced by government policy, by private discrimination, or by the very complex interactions between the two of them, were pervasive features of states at the start of the 20th century, and they remained so long after the first Pan-African Conference was a distant memory. All around the world, people know of the struggle of African-Americans and of South Africa's non-white population for civic equality, but political struggles over racial inequality have been central in the politics of Australia, New Zealand, most of the other countries of these Americas as well. Whether the racial groups seeking justice were First Peoples or the descendants of African slaves or South or East Asian indentured laborers. And this too was part of what Du Bois had in mind. Though he thought of the, he wrote about, in the 1930s, he visited Germany because he'd been to university there, and he wrote about the racism of the Nazis against Jews as well. Over time, as non-Europeans, including many citizens of Europe's former empires in Asia and Africa, have migrated into Europe in increasing numbers, questions of racial inequality in rights, in education, employment and housing, and in income and wealth have come to the fore there too in the European Union countries and in Britain, which used to be one of the European Union countries and isn't now, in part because, I would argue, of some, in part, because of racist attitudes, but we can discuss that later. Racial discrimination and insult remain a global phenomenon. And a good part of why this is seriously wrong is because these attitudes lead to suffering, have led to suffering and death on a global scale for the victims of these racial attitudes. What's at the heart of these problems then? One thing, as we've already seen, is belief in races, but the problem isn't just the thought that you can classify people into a set of mutually exclusive groups on the basis of genetics or some other biological feature that people have because they belong to groups of common ancestry. That turns out to be false, because human beings didn't just spread out of Africa into the world. They were also frequent reversals of flow, as with the migrations, famous migrations of the Arabs, for example, out of Arabia with the rise of Islam and so on, or the other, or the earlier movement west of the Huns under Attila in the 5th century, or more to the point, in these United States, the arrival through the slave trade of nearly 11 million of Africans who survived the Middle Passage to get to the New World. And there has been much more human mixture as a result of the many global migrations of modern times. So this is the shape of the slave trade. These are some of the global migrations of modernity. Europeans, of course, came to the New World in Australasia. Indian indentured laborers and merchants moved within the circuits of the British Empire to the Caribbean, to Latin America, to Africa, and so on. Chinese people, there's huge Chinese diasporas in Southeast Asia, but of course also into the Americas. And the second largest Japanese population in the world is not in a Japanese city, but in Sao Paulo. This is a quick explanation of why the idea that there were these five groups of people who were, as it were, separated until 1492, and then, those are the races. That turns out not to be true, and so that obvious story about why we should classify people in these various groups doesn't seem to work. But the real intellectual error in the kind of belief in races that underlies the sorts of horrors that Du Bois was talking about under his catchphrase of the color line wasn't just thinking you could divide people into biological groups. It was something more substantial. It was what I'm going to call racialism, the belief that there are inherited racial essences which determine and explain not just obvious physical traits like skin color, and hair, and the shape of the eyes or the nose, but other non-physical traits, including particular moral and intellectual ones. This is just the sort of thing you hear when people say that Jews or Gujaratis are naturally good at business, or when in some more intellectual circles, the great British literary critic Matthew Arnold said about the Welsh and Irish in the British Isles, the Celts, sentimental, if the Celtic nature is to be characterized by a single term, is the best term to take. Because this idea, he was talking about Celtic poetry, and these are his lectures on Celtic poetry. Because this idea is associated with belief in some inner property, an essence that is present in all and only the members of the race and explains not just their physical but their moral and intellectual character, it leads people very often to suppose that members of a race have more in common than they actually do, and to suppose as well, also wrongly, that the character of the individual members of a group is to be explained not by something more specific to them, but by something they share with their race. Because it is uncontroversial that racialism of this form is false, I need to say that there are no races, or to give a different alternative account of what they are, since this sort of widely assumed account is mistaken. And I propose we say, this will not surprise my colleague from down the corridor, that racial groups, like many other groups in society, are people who share a certain social identity, like people who share a gender, a class, a religion, a nationality, and so on, and that there are three significant things that all identities have in common that apply to racial identities as well. The first is that every identity comes with labels, so understanding identities requires that you have some ideas about how to apply them. That way you can look for someone of that identity or try to decide of someone you've met whether the label applies. Often, however, and this is why nominalism seems better than realism about these categories, often people disagree about the boundaries here. Is a white Spaniard, Hispanic. But there's usually some consensus about some central cases. Otherwise, these terms, of course, wouldn't have much use for us if we didn't agree about any of their applications. A second point is that membership in an identity group matters for its members' emotions and their deeds. It creates what I've called norms of identification, conceptions of how you ought to behave given your identity. And one of the commonest ways in which it matters is that people feel some sort of solidarity with other members of the group. So their common identity they think of as giving them reason to care about and help one another. And just as there's usually conflict or contest about the boundaries of the group, can a Muslim really be Danish? You know, there are these debates all the time in Europe now. So the debates about who's in and who's out, there's always, almost always, disagreement about what normative significance an identity has. What does being American require of you? I don't think we have a consensus on that. There's a third feature all identities share, which is that, of course, your identity not only gives you reason to do things you think, it also gives other people reasons to do things to you. I've already mentioned something identity can make people do. It can help. They can help you because you share an identity with them. It can generate solidarity, acts of solidarity towards you. But among the most significant things people do with identities is use them as the basis of hierarchies of status and respect and of structures of power. In many places in the world, one ethnic or racial group regards its members as superior to others and assumes the right to better treatment. And of course, attitudes like these look like they're at the heart of racism. So just to summarize all this in these few sentences, identities come with these labels and ideas about them. Your identity shapes your own thoughts about how you should behave, and they affect how other people treat you. And finally, all these dimensions of identity are contestable. They're always up for debate or dispute, who's in, what they're like, and how they should behave and be treated. So, because of these disputes, it can be unclear whether someone has a certain racial identity. Is President Barack Obama, who though born in the United States, I was going to say famously, but had a Kenyan father and a white, and his mother was a white woman born in Kansas, is he really African American? Is he black? Or is he mixed race? Well, the key thing for our purposes is that if someone treats Barack Obama wrongly because they think of him as black, that'll be racist. Whether or not he really is black, which is not a question that we need to decide for those purposes. And from now on, when I talk about someone's race, I'll mean their racial identity in this sense. Though, as I say, what your racial identity is generally speaking, for many people, I think unclear. Or there are many reasonable views about the racial identities of lots of people, none of which I think has any reason for a philosopher to take side on which one is right. I mean, there may be some that philosophers might think are obviously wrong, but there are lots of contestable right ways of doing it. So racialism is not, as I said, in itself a moral problem. It's an intellectual mistake. It can have bad effects, though, because very often part of what racialists believe is that their own race is superior in some way to other races, and that people of other races are therefore less worthy. I once called this belief in the unworthiness of people of a race extrinsic racism. It's extrinsic because you think that it just happens to be true that they're unworthy because they have traits that would be unworthy in anyone. But I'm inclined now to think that that was a bad idea, that labeling, because though extrinsic racism is usually false, it's not usually morally wrong. And as I said, we should keep the term racism for wrongs. So I'm going to call it negative racialism instead. Sometimes people just believe these things because they've been brought up to believe them, but once they're shown that they're false, they just give them up. Still, as we'll see, these beliefs could be the result of a wrong, even if it's not the fault of the people who have the beliefs. Negative racialism can be, as we'll see, a consequence of racist institutions. But even if these negative racialist beliefs are not always morally wrong, they can still have two kinds of bad effects. One is stereotyping, not paying attention to the individual person in front of you and assessing how you treat them on the basis of their own character and behavior. You can have plenty of evidence that someone of another race is honest and still treat them as if they're dishonest, suspecting that it must be they that stole something you can't find, because you think of dishonesty as a trait of their kind, their race. That can lead to the second bad effect, treating people in a way they don't deserve to be treated, as in this case, where someone might be fired or arrested for something they didn't do. Now, the mistakes that people make in this way, because they're racialists, can be corrected, if they're open-minded, by asking them to look properly at the evidence. One of Du Bois's projects throughout his life, and in particular, well, throughout his life, was but he was beginning it in the decade after that passage that I, in 1900, comes from, was to edit an encyclopedia of the black world that would demonstrate that many of the negative things people believed about black people were false. Eventually, though, he gave up thinking that. He went on with the encyclopedia, but he lost his faith that this was an important way of changing people's minds. Here's one reason that he changed his mind. Negative racialism is often the result of something else, which I once called intrinsic racism. This is a matter of thinking that people of some race aren't entitled to the same decent treatment due to people of their own race, simply because they are of a different race. Some people just think their own race is intrinsically more worthy. It may be that someone of another race has nothing especially wrong with them. They're not individually stupid or dishonest or even oversexed or lazy or dirty or any of the other things that negative racialists often say about people of the races they look down on. But that doesn't matter. The intrinsic racist thinks it's okay to treat that individual in ways that members of her own race shouldn't be treated. Now, once you have an attitude like that to a race, negative racialism is quite likely to be part of the package of attitudes that goes with it. That's because once you have a negative attitude to a group, you're more likely to inclined to believe bad things about them. More than that, we'll often express negative racialist ideas about people because they provide a rationalization for our bad treatment of them. It's easier to say that blacks are lazy and stupid or Jews are scheming and clannish than to say, I don't like or I don't care about blacks or Jews. And this gets to a third element of the package of individual racism, because so far I've been talking about beliefs, propositions that people might hold to be true, in the second case, a moral belief. But racism is also about feelings. People can have hatred or contempt for other people on the grounds of their racial identity. Racism has an emotional component. Once people are intrinsic racist, they're quite likely to have not just false beliefs about other races, but I think irrational ones. They won't be any good at assessing the evidence about their other races. They'll engage frequently in motivated reasoning about them. Worse, these irrational beliefs will be very hard to get rid of, especially in the cases where they work, at least in the conscious or unconscious imagination of the racist, to the advantage of his or her kind. And many of us find it hard to give up beliefs that play a part in justifying the advantages we gain or hope to gain from our positions in the social order, in particular beliefs about the positive character of the class of people who share our position. Why are people sometimes like this? One reason is that just the basic us-them features of intergroup psychology. Once we have social groups, we turn them into in-groups and out-groups, and we favor our own kind. Evolutionary psychologists have theories about why that is, but that's one reason why there are, as I said, many other things like racism, Islamophobia, and other forms of religious bigotry, for example, anti-Semitism, which is sometimes conceived in religious and sometimes in ethno-racial terms, and so on. But I think there's a deeper reason for why this sort of package comes together in people in so many societies, and it's not psychological, but sociological. It's not a matter of individual thoughts and feelings, but of social structures. People who have these elements of the individual racism package, the beliefs and these emotions, will end up acting together to maintain social advantages for people of their own racial identity. And because negative racialism provides a rationalization for the bad treatment of less favored races, they will be more comfortable doing so. Often their religious traditions will support them in this, so that it will seem to them that God is on the side of the supremacy of their own race. As a judge in the state of Virginia in 1964, discussing an ACLU motion to vacate the one-year sentence of Mildred Jeter and Richard Loving for miscegenation, which had occurred in 1959 when they got married, as he put it, "Almighty God created the races, white, black, yellow, Malay, and red, and he placed them on separate continents." That's the view that I was trying to suggest is mistaken when I sketched the true history of the movements of our species. But for the interference with this arrangement, there would be no cause for such marriages. The fact that he separated the races shows that he did not intend for the races to mix. Now, remember, this was an American judge in an American courtroom speaking during the Johnson administration. And his decision meant that President Obama's parents had a marriage that was a crime punishable by imprisonment in Virginia until he was nearly 6 years old. Now, there's a philosopher's way of seeing this whole package, not as something that just happens to come together by chance, but as a result of a pervasive system of ideas maintained in place by the fact that it serves certain interests. Philosophers in the Marxist tradition have used the word ideology in this way for a very long time. Ideologies, I'm not saying Tommy is a Marxist, but he is a reader of this tradition, and I'm going to quote his version of this. In this sense, as Tommy Shelby has written, ideologies are widely accepted illusory systems of belief that function to establish or reinforce structures of social oppression. And I think it helps to think of racism, as Shelby does, as, first of all, an ideology, a system of illusory ideas like racialism. That, you'll recall, meant belief in the biological reality of races with essential properties. That ideology leads people to have both negative attitudes and false beliefs about people of their own and other races. Some of these attitudes are vices, as opposed to virtues. It's morally okay to resent someone who's wronged you, or to disapprove of someone who has done something wrong, even if you weren't their victim. But it's a vice to hate or dislike or disrespect someone for no good reason, and being of another racial identity isn't a morally sufficient reason to fail to respect someone. Now, the point about ideologies is that they aren't kept in place simply by chance. There are institutions, schools and colleges, for example, that kept racist ideology in place for a long time in our country, and there were government practices that helped to keep them in place as well. Segregation, for example, made it easier to have false beliefs about other races because it kept the races apart, and it stopped people from forming warm feelings across racial lines, the sort of warm feelings people develop when they live and work together on terms of equality. So what makes these institutions racist is precisely that they serve to sustain and transmit the ideology, that system of ideas, and that, as we've seen, helps perpetuate the individual beliefs and the individual feelings that make individual people racist. Racism, then, is an ideology whose effect is to oppress people of one racial identity or maintain unjust advantages for those of another. Institutions are racist if they function to sustain this ideology, and the ideology has the effect of sustaining the package of beliefs and feelings and traits of character that make individuals racist. So the fundamental wrong in racism is the oppression of one racial group to the advantage of some other, or several. What makes people, beliefs, feelings, institutions, and practices racist is that they contribute to that wrong. Because negative racialist beliefs need not be the fault of the people who have them, it turns out that you can have a racist belief that it's a bad thing to have, but for which you are not to blame. It's wrong, but it's not, so to speak, you're wrong. There are different forms of racism in different places with different histories. Anti-black racism developed in the Atlantic world with the rise of the slave trade. Its effect was to rationalize the appalling treatment of black people that the trade and the practice of enslavement involved, as well as to defend colonial empires. It led to a system of white supremacy where the least advantaged white person had a kind of superior status to any black person. And when slavery ended, the advantages that it had granted white people were substituted for with the system of Jim Crow in particular that developed at the end of Reconstruction. And we're still living with the legacies of that form of white supremacy. So now we have an account that does all the things I said we needed at the start. It says what racism is, and it tells us what we can do about it. It doesn't always blame individual people for contributing to racism because it sees racist attitudes as something produced by institutions that sustain racist ideology. It tells us that racism is morally wrong, and why? Because it's functions to sustain oppression, and it shows why it's possible, not just for people, but also for statements, attitudes, and acts and institutions to be racist. It explains how attitudes and behavior and institutions and practices that are in some way grounded in the race of the people who are its victims, the racial identity, can come together to wrong people by subjecting them to oppression on account of their race. Once we see what racism is, we can also be clear that we want to bring it to an end, and given its pervasiveness, if this is what it is, it's going to be pervasive, that may take a while. But at least once we're clear about what it is, we can set about that task, acting, all of us, whatever our racial identities, in a concerted program to dismantle the racist ideology that has so poisoned the history of this republic of ours as it has poisoned our world. And if you want to say what it is that we're dismantling, it's this racist ideology in our country and elsewhere that serves to oppress people who are not white, in particular through racist institutions. And we can add that it does this in part by creating people who have the vices and the intellectual errors of that I listed earlier. When we say we're against racism, that is what we're trying to bring to an end. Thanks.
Okay, we now have 15 or 20 minutes for questions, which will then be followed by a reception. Why don't you go ahead?
About your conversation.